case number 20-3045, USA versus Davian Warren. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. On, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Matthew.
Did you reserve any time for rebuttal?
I did. I am requesting 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Matthew On, from the Northern Ohio Federal Defender. I represent the appellant, Davian Warren, in this case. I'd like to focus on the breach of the plea agreement issue with my argument time, although I am happy to take questions on the unreasonableness of the sentence as well. However, if this court agrees with Mr. Warren on the plea agreement issue, it does not need to reach the unreasonableness question at all. The parties in this case entered into a plea agreement. In that agreement, the government agreed to not suggest in any way that a sentence outside the guidelines was appropriate. But when defense counsel asked the district court to abide by the will of the parties as represented by the plea agreement, the government disputed that the plea agreement represented the will of the parties. This statement necessarily suggested that an above-guideline sentence was appropriate, which is a breach of the plea agreement. The prior decisions of this court state that Mr. Warren is therefore entitled to be resentenced in front of a different judge. There are two questions that this court must ask, a factual question and then a legal question. The factual question is, did the government suggest in any way that an above-guideline sentence is appropriate?
Is that language seems pretty broad. Is that standard in the Northern District of Ohio? Do you know?
The practice of our office is to tailor plea agreements to the sort of circumstances of each case. I believe this plea agreement was actually entered into not by our office, but by a prior attorney on the case. So I can't speak to this particular language. But that language is in the plea agreement, and since it is plainly in the plea agreement, it should be followed. The language as stated was that, and I quote, neither party will recommend or suggest in any way that a departure or variance is appropriate, end quote. Defense counsel referred to this agreement at the sentencing hearing when at the end of her colloquy, she asked the district court to consider the will of the parties along with other mitigating facts. At the government's first chance to speak, the government stated that it wanted to clarify something that defense counsel brought up, and I quote, because she is asking the court to have a standard of reliance upon this. The government went on to say that it had learned more information since the plea agreement had been executed, and that if it had known that information at the time it entered into the plea agreement, it, and I quote, quite probably would have made different recommendations had it known that information. The necessary inference
counsel,
from that.
Counsel, yes. do you question the veracity of that statement? In other words, do you agree that the government didn't have access to certain information and only learned something later on?
We are not disputing the veracity of that statement, but that is not the relevant factual question here.
Is that information that defense counsel had?
That is.
Would defense counsel have known the specifics of the prior offenses for his client?
Because this was an agreement that was entered into by prior counsel, I can't speak for sure to that. I certainly know that the pretrial report that would have been disclosed to defense counsel at that time would have been the same pretrial report that the government would have had.
So you're saying they probably had equal information. In other words, it'd be one thing if the defendant had specific information the government didn't have and didn't disclose that information, maybe even concealed it, and then sort of later released that information and the government entered into a deal sort of under false pretenses.
Yes, I agree that that those situations feel different. I do not believe that there is any evidence in the record that there was any deliberate concealment or anything of that nature in circumstances surrounding the parties entering into this plea agreement. but the plea agreement is relatively broad. It does not say neither party will recommend a numerical sentence outside the guideline range. It says that any suggestion in any way that a sentence outside the guidelines is appropriate would be outside the bounds of that agreement.
Do you agree, or I'd like to ask your position, I suppose, if there were a breach here, and let's say there's a technical breach, are we allowed to examine whether it was a material breach or not, whether it was a significant breach?
No, Your Honor. The prior decisions of this court, including United States v. Ligon, state that there is no analysis of harm or prejudice or anything of that sort.
But is there a difference between harmlessness, let's say, and let's put that aside for a second. Is there a difference between harmlessness and what might be a trivial or non-material breach, or do you think those are the same concepts?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, I'm thinking about contract, like regular civil contract law. Maybe I'm not damaged, so it's harmless, even if there's a breach. But the breach is, maybe it's a material breach because it breaches an important part of the agreement, or it's not just a technical breach. But then the question of damage might go to whether it was harmless or not. I don't know. I'm just kind of throwing that out there. I'm just wondering if those are the, but I don't know that we've said they're the same thing. Have we?
I do think I understand the distinction Your Honor is considering here. The Ligon and other prior decisions of this court state that the duties that the government has as a result of a plea agreement are to be construed strictly. To the extent that there was a breach, I think that strict construction necessitates that a breach, if it is against the terms of the plea agreement, is therefore material. In this case, I think that the extent of the breaching statement, the fact that the government called into question the will of the parties, which a contract is supposed to represent, and sort of repudiated the language of the agreement in that way, I think that regardless of whether there can be an immaterial breach that does not result in a remedy, this case includes a clearly material breach.
What do we do with the district court's, I mean, the district court himself said he wasn't influenced by it. I take it we don't look at that at all?
Correct. And in Ligon, they address this issue directly, stating, that there is no harmless error analysis required. It does not matter what the judge's response is to a breach. And this is because under contract principles, the contract was formed in this case by the parties, not between Mr. Warren and the court. The breach is the failure of performance on part of the government rather than any outcome with the court. There was no bargained for guaranteed sentence or anything.
I know we've said this is a de novo review, but the judge, when the judge basically says, I don't think there's a breach of the agreement, and he's in the courtroom, he can assess the demeanor of the attorneys. I mean, there's a way to say things and a way not to say things, right? With body language. I mean, we're not saying we wouldn't have entered into this deal, Your Honor. But hey, we intend to honor this agreement, wink, wink, or whatever. I don't know. They could have been different things that went on. And the judge says, well, I don't think there's a breach. Essentially says there's not a breach here. Why wouldn't we give at least some credence to what the trial judge said? I mean, he's like a witness to the alleged breach, right?
I would agree with that, yes. But since this is a de novo review, and in this case, I believe, again, since the breach, I just don't see a way to sort of say this language that the government used in a way that does not call the appropriateness of a guideline range sentence into question. I think that even if there is some deference that is due to the district court's analysis, which a de novo review wouldn't imply that there is not, this is not, I would argue that this is not that close of a case.
What about the government's own statement? So that they, you know, they're aware of the agreement. They say they intend to honor the agreement. They're honoring the agreement. I mean, why can't we kind of take them at their word on that? Is that a cure to the breach, or is that just kind of calling to question whether there's a breach or not?
So as an initial matter, I will note that the Sixth Circuit, this court has not yet ruled on whether a breach of a plea agreement can be cured. Ligon declined to rule on that question. But even under out-of-circuit precedent, where cure has been recognized, a cure must be an unambiguous and unequivocal retraction of the prior statement, not simply a statement that they are not going to, that they will stay within the guidelines range. And in this case, this was not any kind of retraction. And I will quote from the record again. The government said, "I am not going to argue for a sentence higher than 63 months." But immediately following that statement, it then again said, and I quote, "I felt the need to address for the court that had the government had different information, perhaps it might have done something differently." So yet again, it doubled down on the same sort of language that it had used previously in the sentencing colloquy and did not.
What's your test for suggest? I mean, it can't be the rule the government has to stand there silently. And the government appropriately, as Judge Nalbandian points out, prefaced remarks by saying that the government wasn't going back on its agreement and is still bound by it. And the government go ahead.
Go ahead, answer, counsel.
So I agree that the government does not have to, it can begrudgingly uphold the terms of the plea agreement. But I think that in this case, suggesting that it would not have entered into that plea agreement undermines the entire agreement. I think if the government simply had said, "We have this this information that these particular convictions were more serious than they might appear on paper," that is perfectly in bounds. The concern here is that they injected material reservations.
It's really that last paragraph that puts it over the top in your mind, or the last paragraph before the objection.
Yes, that's correct. It's the fact that they're really calling into question the agreement itself in this case.
Because why can this also be read as just a suggestion that this should be higher and staying within the guideline range? This should just be on the higher end rather than the lower end because X, Y, and Z reasons.
I think if the government is expressing some level of displeasure at the fact that they're limited to 63 months on the high end, that's necessarily an inference that they would be arguing for something above the top end of what they are allowed to argue. And so, again, because the language in the plea agreement is so broad, because it says you cannot suggest in any way that a different sentence would be appropriate, this qualifies, especially when you take the fact that the duties of the government must be construed strictly.
Can I ask a question about harmlessness? I'm sorry, I want to go back to that. What do we do? I don't think our cases have really grappled with Puckett and whether Puckett clearly, I think, leaves open the possibility of harmlessness in this area. And I think the result in Puckett in saying it's essentially not a structural error, it's subject to plain error review. Those kinds of errors we always review for harmlessness. Why wouldn't that same logic apply in this context?
So the Supreme Court in Santabello, with language that was quoted in Ligon, justified the lack of harmless error or prejudice analysis by saying that the interests of justice and appropriate recognition of the duties of the prosecution in relation to promises made in the negotiation of pleas of guilty necessitate a remand, even if the district court does not take the breaching statements into account. And I know that I'm out of time, but I just want to make one final point on that note, that Mr. Warren, in exchange for the consideration he got, gave up some of his fundamental constitutional rights in this plea agreement. This is a statement that, a principle that is noted in Ligon and in other prior decisions of this court. And so those promises should not be taken lightly. I will reserve the rest of my argument for rebuttal unless there are any further questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Rebecca Lutzko on behalf of the United States. I too will focus the bulk of my argument regarding the breach issue. However, I would very clearly state the government's position that this sentence was substantively reasonable and note that the district court did exactly what this court directed it to do upon remand and consider the distinctions between other offenders in the same criminal history category and did not rely simply on the criminal record and other factors that the guidelines already addressed, but made very clear both at sentencing and in its supplemental memo why it believed that a 96-month sentence as opposed to its previous 120-month sentence was appropriate. Turning to the issue of whether or not the government breached the plea agreement, it is the government's position that we did not. And I think that the court needs to look at the statements that were made in the context of this entire record, which this court has recognized in a case that the government did not previously cite in its brief. And so I bring to your attention right now, which is United States versus Mizen, M-I-E-Z-I-N, citation 586 Fed appendix, sorry, 197 from 2014. It is an unpublished case, no, but nonetheless.
Counsel, we all miss cases, that happens. I used to be an appellate lawyer, I missed cases all the time. But if you're gonna rely on it during argument, it's really helpful to just like submit it. If it's the first case you're gonna rely on, if it's your first case you're gonna rely on oral argument, you know, just think about submitting it to us, at least we have it, because I have no idea what that case says.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I do apologize for not doing that. I will certainly
you're pretty regular. I know you're pretty regular in front of our court. So just
yes, and we file a lot of Rule 28J letters, and I do apologize. I would, however, though, just note there, as well as in the cases that the government did cite in its brief, Mason and Wilcoxon in particular, where the government was explaining why it entered a plea agreement there. And here, that is what is going on. As the record reflects in this second sentencing agreement, the defense argument, their opening lead and their closing lead in both cases, what that was an emphasis on the fact that this was the will of the parties, that this was what the parties were agreeing to, a guideline sentence, and therefore that's why the district court ought to impose it, as opposed to the typical situation where the parties do come in and argue the merits of why you should fall into one or the other.
Was there something wrong with that argument?
There's nothing wrong with the argument, but it does raise by the emphasis on this being the will of the parties, it does raise and call into question what the parties knew at the time. And the prosecutor clearly was very clearly responding to the that point. And I think if you look at the first.
But counsel, you have an agreement. So, well, first of all, let me say a lot of these other cases, the prosecutor's responding to the court.
That is correct.
And as an officer of the court, you can see that at least in some of the cases, the prosecutor is very carefully balancing the obligation under the agreement and being an officer of the court responding to the judge. Mm-hmm. But this wasn't a response to the judge. This was the defendant rightfully is relying on a negotiated agreement, stressing that to the court. And then the prosecutor says, well, you know, when we agreed to it, we really didn't know this. So, you know, the agreement really doesn't mean much. And you shouldn't feel like you have to sentence within that agreement, in effect.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think the prosecutor took great pains not to say exactly that and to point out that the recommendation from the government was agreed to and always would be a sentence within the guideline range here at the high end of the guideline range. And I would point, Your Honors, for comparison's sake, to the first sentencing argument where the prosecution and defendant at that point had all of the same information because at that point the PSR had been prepared. And there the prosecutor came in and didn't know there would be a resentencing. The defendant made his substantive arguments and the government made its substantive arguments and didn't say, oh, by the way, Your Honor, we didn't know at the time that that these prior convictions were so significant. So when you juxtapose that with here, the only difference here is the defendant's emphasis. It's the first thing out of her mouth at the opening, and it's the first thing out of her mouth at the substance.
I don't understand the argument. I mean, if there's, you're saying there's like a mutual mistake of fact, why didn't you try to negate the agreement then? I mean, why do you, I mean, I don't, I mean, the will of the parties you're talking about, and you're saying, well, it's not really the will of the parties. We didn't agree by the time of the second sentencing, right?
Well, it was the same. I apologize if I'm not answering this directly, but it was the same agreement and same understanding both by the time of the first sentencing and the second sentencing. The government agreed, you know, the government entered that agreement and agreed to be bound by it. And then very, I would say, forcefully made a recommendation for the high end of the sentencing range, pointing to the extreme nature of the violence and also acknowledging the other 3553 actors in arguing for that. So I would say first and foremost, there was not a breach, but if Your Honors were inclined to find otherwise, that breach was cured certainly by the overall context and the argument that the government actually did make here requesting.
So let me go back to the breach for a second, because I'm a little bit confused. What's the point? What was the point of the statement saying, you know, basically we wouldn't have entered into this agreement or we would have made different recommendations? What was the purpose of that statement?
So, Your Honors, I think the purpose of the entire statement was to respond to the emphasis that the defense placed on that this is what everybody wanted here and believed was what this court should do because this is what the two parties wanted. I would agree with Your Honor, of course.
Are you saying counsel? I mean, I had sort of wondered this when I read your briefs. Are you saying defense counsel opened the door in a way to some reason for you to go back to the history underlying the agreement and suggest that maybe you're cold feet?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Which page of the transcript, sentencing transcript, are you referring to there? Because I've read it, I didn't really see it. But
So how we viewed it and how the AUSA viewed it, I would point your direct Your Honors to page ID 444 as well as 460. Of the agreement, I'm sorry, of the sentencing transcript.
Yeah, I unfortunately only have a vision in front of me that is just our.
So you're saying that because defense counsel said to the court, this is what the parties agreed to, and this is what you should do because of that, you had the right to say, well, we didn't really agree to it because we didn't have the full information.
So again, Your Honor, I would say that in the context of the entire, in the comments were made and responding to that, that the prosecutor was clear to say that this, not that this is not what we agreed to, and we're going to be bound by what we agreed to, which was to recommend a sentence within the guideline range. And she argued for a sentence at the high end of that range, but that when the defense counsel said, I would like to begin by addressing the court's notice of an upward variance, we would encourage this court to impose a sentence within the guideline range, in part because the parties in crafting an agreement, and I'm dropping a few words here, all agreed that a guideline range was the appropriate sentence here. And then in turning to the summation of the same, she further argued that, in summary, I would ask the court to consider the will of the parties, the guideline right. range.
So the response to that should be, yes, this was the agreement. We urge you to sentence at the very top of that range because of these factors.
And Your Honor, I would submit that she felt, the AUSA here felt the need to respond to the factual distinction, but nonetheless ultimately made that argument. I would agree with you that perhaps the last portion of her statement was unfortunate phrasing, absolutely. And that could we go back in hindsight, I would have preferred that she focus on simply the mere factual distinction that this information was not in front of the government. But nonetheless,
can I ask you why? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you about that point you just made, counsel. So I'm trying to figure out what information the government had available to it, because either it did, I don't know if the PSR was done at that point, either the government did have access to this information or it didn't, but I suspect this is like any other case where the government also doesn't have access to the information at the time it agrees to a plea agreement, in which case, in every case, the government can come forward and say, well, gee, we entered this at one point, but we didn't have all the information, and you essentially can make this argument in every case. So I'm not sure which one it is. Is it the latter, that you didn't have access?
So my understanding was that we had the convictions themselves, because those were what was charged as part of the felon in possession crime, the prior disqualifying convictions. But we did not have, when we entered the plea agreement, the underlying facts relating to those convictions, and that those, obviously the defendant would know those, but did
so
not
you discovered
tell us.
Those.
And I'm not saying they had to tell us either.
Can I ask you, counsel, did you discover those yes. through the PSR? Is that when that came to light or what?
Yeah,
or what?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, that is reflected in the PSR, the details. That's part of what the probation office.
Really, this is how it almost always would work. So you're almost yes. always entering into these agreements without perfect information, but that's, I guess, sort of the price of poker in this context, maybe.
I would absolutely concede that the government does not always have perfect information at the time, and that a lot of these things, the details regarding prior convictions, do frequently come out in a as part of the preparation of the PSR. Here, however, those are fairly extreme facts that did come out. And I think that.
So did you try to get released from the agreement? In the sense that defendant no longer pleads guilty, but, you know, you don't agree to the guidelines. I mean, did you attempt to do that?
I do not believe there was ever that attempt made. And I would again focus Your Honors on the distinctions that were, or the differences between the first sentencing hearing in this case, when defense counsel did not place any sort of emphasis on the will of the parties and this point, and the second, and that I think that reflects what the AUSA was doing here and demonstrates how it is that she was responding to the arguments made, as opposed to affirmatively attempting to somehow breach the plea agreement. I know my time is getting short, and I would like to address one point that Judge Nalbandian made in particular regarding Puckett. So The Puckett case, I think, from the Supreme Court absolutely contemplates the ability to cure a breach. And in Ligon, this court left that issue open.
Can I ask you a question? Because I'm a little bit confused about your briefing. I don't really see a cure argument, a materiality, immateriality argument, or a harmlessness argument. You're really focused on whether there was a breach or not. Is that right?
I think that is correct. That is an accurate reflection of the brief. And with respect to harmlessness, I would concede that based on this court's opinion in Ligon and reliance on Santabello, that harmlessness is not as aggravating as it might be here, because I don't think the government's comments affected the district court. Nonetheless, the government would concede that a harmlessness error is not appropriate.
I don't understand why you would concede that. I think Puckett leaves it open. Puckett knew Santabello was out there. I mean, you can concede whatever you want. We won't.
Well, I guess it just seems odd
that you wouldn't argue that footnote leaves it open, and it's not a structural error. We always do harmlessness on plain error review. We look at whether it affects substantial rights. It'd be the similar analysis. You can do whatever you want. It's your case.
Well, in that situation, Puckett was on plain error. And yes, you're absolutely correct that there was no strike. They made very clear it wasn't a structural issue. But this court's opinion in Ligon, I believe, forecloses me from making that argument. I would, however, say that Ligon left open, and Puckett certainly contemplates the ability of the government to cure a breach. And it related to that point. You had asked my opponent, and I would note that the government does believe the breach does have to be material in nature. I'm happy to answer additional questions, but I do see that my time is up.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a couple quick points about the government's argument. First, with respect to Meisen, the unpublished prior case of this court, it appears based on a quick review of the opinion that in that case, when pushed by the court, the government in that case stated that yes, Your Honor, and I quote, "I entered into that agreement and I stand by my agreement," even though the court ended up applying a different guideline range than the one contemplated in the agreement. As to cure, I think it's important that we note that the other circuits that have addressed the question of cure really talk about a retraction of a statement, not just a clarification. A proper cure, therefore, would probably, in this case, look something along the lines of, "I'd like to correct the record, Your Honor. Earlier, I stated that we would not have entered into this agreement had we known all of the information we know now. That was an incorrect statement. We would have entered into that agreement, and we stand by that agreement, even with the information that we know now." And the question of whether,
but what if that's not what if that's not true? I mean, it would. I don't know what the cure would look like, but I mean, maybe the government attorney isn't willing to say that they would have entered into it, because in fact, it's true that they would not have entered into it. I don't know what the answer is, but I don't know that they have to. I mean, that they don't have to state something that's not true, do they, in order to cure, if they don't believe it?
I think that if they choose not to because they don't believe it, then it is an uncured breach at that point. And therefore, the defendant would be entitled to a remand for resentencing in front of a different judge, which is the remedy of the two available remedies that Mr. Warren has asked for. I think that the correct answer is for the government not to breach the agreement in the first place. And had they done so, the question of a cure would not even be at issue in the first place. I'd just like to reiterate that Mr. Warren does request a remand for resentencing in front of a different judge rather than a withdrawal of his plea. If there are no further questions, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you both. Appreciate the arguments. Case will be submitted.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.